Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice-monthly port of call for gaming news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slagkick.
Yarr!
Today is September 21st, 2014, and this is episode 64, Nintendo Ultra 64. Welcome once again.
Wait. I thought we were talking about the Jaguar.
Ugh, girl, no. Ain't nobody got nothing to say about the Jaguar. Welcome once again, our lovely and beautiful listeners.
Wait. I thought this was our two-part 32X episode.
Are you serious with this right now?
Yeah, 32 times 2 is 64.
Welcome again, our lovely and beautiful listeners, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
This week, in celebration of making it all the way up to episode 64, we are going to be talking about Nintendo's Nintendo 64 console.
Wait, we're not talking about Kadabra, who is Pokemon number 64?
I cannot even. We want to first, of course, dedicate our episode this week to Douglas E. Smith. He was the creator of the classic game Lode Runner. He unfortunately passed away last week.
Oh, that's really sad.
Our hearts and thoughts go out to his family. And, you know, certainly I will have to be loading up Lode Runner this week to sort of celebrate his creation.
Load up the load.
Anyway, we have a lot of news and follow-ups this week, as Tokyo Game Show also happened this week. So, in the interest of our time and yours, let's get this show on the road. Slaggy, you want to get us started?
Sure. A shiny Gengar is coming to Pokemon X and Y at GameStop. This will be from October 13th to 26th, holding a Gengarite Megastone. From October 27th to November 16th, there will be a Diancie at GameStop, and then the Megastone for Diancie is included in Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire.
Oh, excellent.
They are also, these are being held in celebration of the XY Phantom Forces expansion of the trading card game.
Excellent. We also have word here that the upcoming fourth game in the Way of the Samurai series will be coming to PC via Steam.
Oh, that's nice.
We don't yet have a release date for the game, but Ghostlight, who will be publishing, says that they are hard at work on the PC conversion and will have more news to share in the very near future.
Excellent. The Assassin's Creed Kenway bundle, I guess you could look at it as, will be bundled up into The Assassin's Creed American Saga is being bundled up for an October release. That is Assassin's Creed Birth of a New World, the American Saga, in Europe, or just Assassin's Creed the Americas Collection in North America. That includes Assassin's Creed 3, Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag, and Assassin's Creed Liberation HD.
This bundle will be launching in Europe on October 3rd and October 28th in North America. We also have here another set of new 3DSs for Japan release. These are both going to be Pokemon-themed new 3DS XLs. There's a red Groudon and a blue Kyogre. And something that's actually really exciting about this is that they have actually like a suede finish.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I think they look really cool, and I'm definitely going to try to get one of these if I can.
Yeah, I don't know how I'd feel about having a suede, handheld, but I'd probably want to pet it all the time.
We also have word here that there's going to be a demo version of Pokemon Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire prior to the game's releases later this year, November 21st to be specific. This demo is going to feature special scenarios that are not in the full game and will allow you to trade the Pokemon you catch in it to your full game when the game comes out.
Omega Ruby.
So yeah, if you're interested in Pokemon Alpha and Omega, I would definitely recommend keeping your ear to the ground for news on this upcoming demo.
Yeah. Tekken 7 is going to have location tests starting in October. There's going to be the Namco Sugamo Cup event. There's going to be October 3rd through 5th machines at Namco Sugamo store in Tokyo and the Nippon Bashi store in Osaka. If you are a location tester, you'll get special Tekken stickers and Bana Passport cards as a gift.
We also have news here that Square Enix is actively expanding the development team for Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yeah.
Most specifically, on their website, we are seeing, help wanted ads for programmers to start working on the game, specifically with regard to user interface design, but also like a technical artist position and a network programmer's position. So we definitely have every indication that Kingdom Hearts 3 is finally a thing that's, you know, being made. So that's very exciting. We also have word here, you know, we've talked previously about how Dragon Quest X was getting a port of sorts to the 3DS platform. You know, it was gonna basically be streaming the game online and not actually running the game locally. Apparently this was a bad plan. This game has been taken off of the market in Japan, both in terms of being recalled from store shelves and no longer is it available on the eShop, because apparently Square Enix's servers were overrun with requests for play sessions and they could no longer run enough streaming instances to support the demand for this game.
Ugh.
Yeah, so that's definitely another wrinkle in the ongoing Dragon Quest X saga.
Yeah. In some almost doom and gloom news, Harmonix has closed the Rock Band network. Now, my understanding is that you're still able to download and purchase. You just will not be adding new songs, but, that remains to be seen. I haven't had a chance to check it out myself. But commenters in the news story on Joystick, which you can get at GameBuie.org,
you can find a link over at GameBuie.org.
Said they were still able to download, so.
Yeah, the actual store is staying up. What's coming down is just the framework that allows people to submit songs to Harmonix for review to be published.
Right.
And Harmonix has acknowledged that the songs that were already in the pipeline but not released yet, unfortunately, will not be able to be saved and will not be published.
That's a bummer.
Specifically cited that the technical team doing all of this has since been laid off, and they no longer have the staff to support this functionality.
Aww.
So, yeah, that's the unfortunate downside to the downsizing that we've seen Harmonix undertake in the last year. We also have word here that Super Smash Bros. For 3DS in Japan recently got a patch that adds the Conquest Battles functionality. And what this basically is when you play online, you will have a little prompt for, like, what characters are super popular right now, and if those characters are being played in your current match and you win, you will get bonus customization items and in-game gold for having participated in, like, this conquest. So, for example, if there's a Mario versus Bowser versus Link conquest, if you play as any of those three characters and win, then you'll get bonus items.
Wow.
Now, this to me, and I mean this in the best possible way, this to me seems like a balancing act, like a test for balancing characters that they're having the user base do without, you know, really being open about it and sort of creating this framework that rewards them in-game. You know, we often talk here on the show about, you know, the difficulties of balancing fighting games and what have you. You know, usually with a QA department working on a game, even a major game like Smash Brothers, you're only really looking at, you know, 50 to a couple hundred people, you know, working on balancing and making sure characters play correctly against each other. And as soon as you open up sort of your game to a huge player base, in the instance of Smash Brothers 3DS, we're already looking at millions of players in Japan. Immediately you start to see inequities in sort of individual character design and ability. So this, to me, seems like a really clever way for Nintendo to find out, in a situation where Mario is against Bowser and Link, is Mario always going to do well, or is he always going to do poor? And presumably they'll be able to use that data to tweak and patch, ongoing balance of the game. Which is something we see fighting game developers do a lot, so, you know, it certainly has a lot of precedent. I think this is just a really great initiative coming out of Nintendo for this game.
Yeah. I'm glad that they're, you know, supporting it so much. Ultra Street Fighter 4, speaking of fighting games, is going to be getting a free Omega Mode, which is a DLC pack that switches up the normal and special attacks of the entire Ultra roster. And they mentioned that the Omega Mode is focused on fun, so balancing every minute character strength was less of a priority, in favor of making the roster's collective set feel fresh. but they'll only be able to play unranked matches online, as you might expect. Also, in the PC realm, there will be a version 1.04 patch that will help some network issues and fixes such.
Excellent. That's great news. You know, I love Street Fighter. I love Street Fighter 4. I think Ultra is mostly a really great add-on. And I love the idea of adding, like, a Omega mode where, you know, balancing is a little less of a priority and just having fun, giving characters back some moves that have been
removed.
This is
Omega. We're having fun.
Pretty much. Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Speaking of PC and fighting games, Dragon Ball Xenoverse has been announced to be coming to Steam.
Oh, excellent. That's great.
This was announced at a pre-Tokyo Game Show showcase at Bandai Namco.
Excellent. And to wrap up our follow-ups here, we have a set of updates of various release dates for a bunch of games that we've talked about here on the show.
Batman Arkham Knight launches June 2nd, 2015. Oh, yeah, bro. Oh.
We also have word here that Drive Club is going to be releasing October 7th as a full retail game and with a free edition for PlayStation Plus members. The PlayStation Plus edition will include 10 cars and 5 tracks with up to 11 variations, while the full game will feature 20 cars and 25 tracks with 55 routes.
Huh. Interesting.
Indeed. And those who download the Plus version for free can upgrade it to the full game for $50 rather than the $60 that buying it outright would cost you.
That's pretty nice, I guess.
Yeah, right?
Gives you a chance to try it out on Plus, and if you're super into it, get you a little bit of a bonus.
PC gamers can get their hands on a remake of Gabriel Knight, Sins of the Father, on October 15th.
Daddy.
Over on Steam, Good Old Games, and Phoenix Road Studios online store.
Mega Man 7 is now available on the Wii U eShop.
Yeah, that was actually a surprise little release that they did last week, where just some random Friday, you know, they had a little, like, online event, and they were like, oh, hey, by the way, you can go play Mega Man 7 on Wii U right now.
And I've never realized that 7 is rare.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a Super Nintendo game, so...
Right.
And it was done after, you know, the core series had taken a break for a while, and everyone thought we had moved on to X full-time. And then they were like, LOL, classic Mega Man's back, here's 7. But
yeah.
At that point, you know, they weren't making a ton of SNES carts or whatever, so... Yeah. We also got a surprise release of Dragon Quest in English on iOS.
Wow.
And Android. It is a $2.99 download. And again, if you want to play the first Dragon Quest, which I certainly do, this is probably your best, most legal bet at the moment.
Wow, that's not a lot of money. I see, like, the screenshot of the king, and I just think of Game Center CX.
Right. We also have word here that the Grand Theft Auto V HD remaster for current gen.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Well, I mean, last gen was HD, so.
That's the joke. Is going to be releasing on November 18th and on PC in 2015.
Huh, okay.
Specifically on January 27th, 2015. We also have word that Disgaea 5 will be releasing in Japan on March 26th, 2015.
Oh.
Nipponichi also announced during that same live stream that they are already planning and developing for the Western release of this game. So those of you who, like me, are waiting for the English localized version of Disgaea 5, we don't have a date yet, but it is coming. And I'm just going to say right now, I would bet on it being that summer, because that seems to be their typical window for these games.
Yeah. And speaking of summer 2015, Bandai Namco has announced that Tales of Zestiria will be coming to North America and Europe, probably by that time. It hits Japan on January 22nd of next year, so they're hoping to get it out localized quicker than they're used to in the series of Tales games.
Man, here's one I'm really happy to talk about. I've mentioned here on the show for the last year or two now that, you know, I was waiting for the break record version of Devil Survivor 2 to come out. This is, of course, the 3DS version of the DS game Devil Survivor 2.
Right.
And, you know, we actually hadn't heard anything about this game in, like, almost a full year. Well, it's now back on, finally almost done with it, and it's going to be coming out in Japan on January 29th, 2015.
Wow.
We don't have any news yet on a localized version, but, you know, these Shin Megami Tensei spin-off games, we tend to get most of them now, knock on wood. So hopefully we'll hear something about this, pretty quick.
Speaking of Shin Megami Tensei spin-off games, unfortunately, Persona 4 Dancing All Night has been delayed until next year.
Well, that sucks, but, you know, at the same time, it's not like we're hurting for new games for the rest of this year.
Especially since Sonic Boom Wii U is coming out a week early. That means that Rise of Lyric, Sonic Boom for Wii U, is going to be coming out the same day as the 3DS version, Shattered Crystal.
Excellent. You know, I am not that excited for this game, but I still, like, am super morbidly curious. So I'll definitely be at least renting this or something. And, you know, hopefully it'll be good.
Yeah, we'll see.
Last but certainly not least, in additional surprise release news, this past Friday, D4, Dark Dreams Don't Die, the cel-shaded mystery game from Deadly Premonition designer Swery65, released on the Xbox One.
What?
This is a $15 download, and it includes the first three episodes of the game. That is the prologue, the first episode, and the second episode. We don't yet know when the additional episodes are going to be coming out, and I haven't had a chance to play this yet. I would expect to hear about it next week on GameBuie.
GameBuie.
So, with all of these follow-ups having been said, it's time for a little bit of...
news. 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 Oh my god. News.
First up, we have news here from last week that Microsoft has confirmed that they have purchased Minecraft studio Mojang. We talked about this here on the show previously, that it looked like Microsoft was looking to spend about $2 million to buy Mojang and the Minecraft IP. We can now confirm that Microsoft paid $2.5
billion. $2.5
billion. For Mojang as well as the Minecraft IP. The interesting twist here is that Mojang founders Notch, Carl Manet, and Jacob Porser will all be leaving. This has been completely confirmed. It is completely true and real. The most interesting wrinkle to this is, despite Minecraft now being a Microsoft product, they are going to continue to make it available on iOS, Android, and PlayStation platforms, in addition to Xbox, PC, and Windows Phone. It has been confirmed by Mojang's Owen Hill that they are going to continue developing, selling, and supporting Minecraft both generally as well as on all of these platforms that they're already on. And ultimately, you know, there is a really heartfelt blog post by Notch on his personal website about how, you know, he basically sold the studio because he has basically lost his creative spark from being like a CEO of Mojang and not being able to just sit down and make games that are fun to make. He just, you know, everything got to be too much for him. He couldn't really handle both managing Minecraft and also making games. And so he thought it would be better for everyone involved to let, you know, Minecraft be handled by someone who has the tools and experience to support a game like this. So, you know, I like Minecraft. I enjoy dabbling with it. Ultimately, I see this as a good thing because, you know, I'm a PC gamer. But I wouldn't be that surprised if Minecraft 2 doesn't come down the line in the next few years. And I wonder if Microsoft will still be letting it go to all platforms at that point.
Well, it might be a timed exclusive or something.
Indeed. Anyway, the sale has happened. Minecraft is now a Microsoft product. And that's really crazy to me. We also have news here that the PC ports of Resident Evil 5, Dead Rising 2, and Dead Rising Off the Record are going to be transitioned from being Microsoft Games for Windows Live games, and instead having the Steamworks frameworks take its place as far as the digital rights management issues go.
Lovely.
Indeed. So that's, you know, that's a very, very good thing. We've talked about other games that have undergone this transition in the last year, and I'm happy that this trio of Capcom jewels will be making the transition too.
Yeah.
We also have word that Pikmin Short Movies, a collection of animated shorts produced by Shigeru Miyamoto, will be debuting at the Tokyo International Film Festival sometime during the festival's run from October 25th to October 31st.
That sounds super cute.
Yeah, I'm really stoked to hear that. I cannot wait. And, you know, I'm sure these will end up on the eShop or something. Maybe viewable in 3D. That would be cute.
Oh. Peggle Blast is blasting its way to iOS and Android this fall. This is a new game in the Peg-busting series, and it will be free to play. Woohoo!
All right. You know, I'm a big fan of Peggle, so I'm really excited to hear about this. We also have word here from Bandai Namco that they're going to be releasing another Taiko no Tetsujin game in Japan for the Wii U. This one is Taiko no Tetsujin Extra Large Serving. And this is actually going to have the largest number of songs of any game in the entire franchise. It's going to have more than 100 songs on disc. Presumably, it will also have DLC since that's become a mainstay of the series.
Part of me is saying, do you want to chip in and split the cost of an import?
Do you want to build a snowman?
It makes me sad that I cannot play these Taiko no Tetsujin games.
Right. It's going to be releasing in Japan, of course, on November 20th. Oh, how funny. That's like a Bimani day. And there will be a standalone drum available for 3,800 yen. The standalone game is 5,210 yen. And the game and Taiko drum bundle is 8,070 yen.
Aw.
So, please look forward to it, and I just might hit you up on that later, Slykick.
Yep.
We also have word here from Katsuhiro Harada-san, whom most people are primarily familiar with as his role with the Tekken series, basically that he's aware that there is demand for an HD collection of Xenosaga, but, you know, while it's possible that they could make such a thing, they would need to see an internet campaign happen of tens of thousands of fans letting Bandai Namco know that people want to play this game and that they would buy this game. So if you're interested in a Xenosaga HD collection, you need to start tweeting.
Oh, wow.
Like, this is a real thing. Bandai Namco is specifically asking you, please let us know if you would buy this. If you would, we very well may make it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, it really does feel like sort of things are changing with how these companies interact with their fans. We also have word here that Steve Yaros from Volition, whom you're probably familiar with for the most recent iterations of the Saints Row series, has left Volition and is taking on a producer position at Valve.
Aww.
So, you know, it's a little bit sad, but at the same time...
That sounds like it's a perfect fit for him, though.
Yeah, Valve is like a real think tank. Someone like that is gonna just really thrive there.
Yeah, and he's a bearded cutie.
Well, that is also true. We also have word here of the upcoming mobile phone and Vita game called Zodiac. This is going to be developed by the French studio Koboyo, and they've actually assembled a team of names that you might be more familiar with as a fan of the Final Fantasy series. Specifically, Kazushige Nojima-san, the scenario writer for Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy X, is on board, as well as composer Hitoshi Sakimoto-san, whom you are probably familiar with as the composer for the Final Fantasy Tactics games.
Wow.
And it also has other, you know, creative talent working on it. Zodiac is currently scheduled to launch in 2015, and I think this is going to be one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, the reveal trailer looks super gorge.
And I'm sure you're going to want to talk about this one.
Yes. We have some information about free Hyrule Warriors DLC that is launching on October 16th in Europe. It's including three playable villains, Sia, Volga, and Wizro. And this is also coming to Japan, but we don't know if we're getting it over here. But what we can expect that there will be, in all regions, four pieces of paid DLC. And if you get them all in a $20 season pass, you get a Dark Link costume. The four DLC packs are going to have mixes of new characters, weapons, maps, and costumes. The reason I say math is because there's Master Quest DLC on October 16th, Twilight Princess in November, and what most of us are freaking out about is the Majora's Mask pack in January, followed by a Ganon pack in February.
Excellent, excellent. We also have here a whole bevy of Final Fantasy news. You know, something a lot of people have been talking about this week during Tokyo Game Show is that it feels like Final Fantasy is finally coming back as a real force in the gaming industry. So first off, we have here, and this isn't Final Fantasy specific except in name, but Square Enix is launching what they recall a revolutionary cloud-based gaming service that they are calling Shinra Technologies. This is going to be a subsidiary to Square Enix, helmed by Wada-san, the former president of Square Enix.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, this is actually pretty exciting. And funny enough, they're actually, and this, I'm not joking here, they're working with Avalanche on the tech here. You may recall that they acquired the Avalanche studio that is behind the Just Cause series. And now Avalanche is working with Shinra for game streaming, possibly live streaming.
Who would have thought that would happen?
Right. In actual Final Fantasy news, though, we have really incredible confirmation that Final Fantasy 13, like the entire trilogy, is going to be getting a PC release on Steam.
Wow.
The first game is going to be releasing on October 9th for $16. It will be available both on Steam and Square Enix's online store, and it will have all of the cool bonuses that most of the Final Fantasy games have that are on Steam. You know, Steam trading cards and all of that stuff.
Fabulous. Novala Crystallis.
Indeed. The rest of the trilogy, they say, is currently scheduled to release before spring 2015. So I would expect, like, we're going to probably get one of these games every 3 months or so.
Yeah.
I'm excited about this because I think that Final Fantasy 13, while maybe not perfect, is really underappreciated. I think it's a lot better than people typically give it credit
for. Yeah.
We also have word here that Tetsuya Nomura-san is no longer working on Final Fantasy 15. He has moved on to start working in full-time on Kingdom Hearts 3, and Hajime Tabata-san, whom you're probably familiar with as the game director of Final Fantasy Type-0 and Final Fantasy 7 Before Crisis, will be taking over to finish the game.
Nice.
Yeah, so, you know, previously Tabata-san was the co-director of Final Fantasy 15, so I don't think 15 is going to suffer for this at all. I think this is a really natural evolution here. I think this makes complete sense, and I'm really excited because this shows that Final Fantasy 15 is a real game that will get released someday.
Yeah.
We also have news here that Final Fantasy 4 got a stealth Steam release last week. Final Fantasy 4 is now available on Steam this very moment for $16. This is, of course, the 3D version of the game that was originally remade for the Nintendo DS back in 2007, which has had releases on other platforms, including but not limited to mobile. And we also have news here that Final Fantasy Ajito is getting an expansion. This is, of course, the mobile social game based on the Final Fantasy Type-0 universe. This is going to be called Final Fantasy Ajito Plus, and it's going to be releasing on iOS, Android, and Vita. So this is, you know, pretty exciting. The game will be available digitally for free, and there will be a retail package that will cost 3,800 yen.
Interesting.
We don't yet have any word on a Western release of Final Fantasy Ajito or Final Fantasy Ajito Plus, but I would expect to hear something about that after we get Type-0. So keep your ears open for that. We also have word here that Final Fantasy 1 is getting another remake, this time for the Nintendo 3DS. It will be an eShop exclusive, it will have 3D support, and it's going to be releasing on December 18th, the same date as Final Fantasy Explorers in Japan. Final Fantasy Explorers' first print copies will have a code to download the game for free, and the game will go up for normal sale the following month. This remake is based on the PSP Anniversary remake that came out some number of years ago, but while it uses a lot of the same sprites for the characters and enemies, the world environment has been remade and is in 3D, like polygon.
Yeah, it looks actually really cool.
Yeah, you know, I find it very reminiscent of the DS Dragon Quest remakes, and I think those are gorgeous, so I'm really excited about this. Speaking of Final Fantasy Explorers, It's going to be getting a demo in Japan with full internet multiplayer, and you'll be able to play through basically like the prologue of the game and transfer your save data from the demo to the full version of the game when it releases in Japan on December 18th.
It's a playable teaser.
It is effectively a playable teaser.
We've seen a lot of those these days.
And last but not least in this Final Fantasy buoy, we have a release date for Final Fantasy Type-0 HD. That's going to be March 17th for North America for PS4 and PlayStation 1. And first print copies are going to come with a code for a demo of Final Fantasy 15.
Whoa!
This playable demo has already been shown at Tokyo Game Show. There are videos of it up on the internet. Square Enix has not confirmed whether or not we'll be getting the demo the same day as Type-0 HD comes out, but, you know, it's very clear since they've already talked about how the playable demo is playable at events, and they've made it very clear that they hope to have it up around the same time.
Yeah. And can I just say that Noctis's friend with, like, the open jacket is super studly?
Yeah, I'm really feeling the characters.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are kind of like, oh, there's not a lot of, female representation. It's like a bro road trip. That was kind of the original premise as it was.
Yeah, and, you know, something else we didn't really talk about here, because, you know, it's not news necessarily, is that there was a new trailer for Final Fantasy XV.
Yeah.
It's clearly a real game. It now clearly has real game systems. I think it's safe to say this is really happening.
Yep.
We also have word out of Tokyo Game Show that we're getting a new Raiden game. The Raiden games, of course, are the arcade-style shoot-em-ups. This is, of course, a well-loved classic series. The interesting thing is that Raiden 5 is going to launch on the Xbox One.
Oh.
Yeah, so, you know, that's very interesting. Some, you know, hardcore Japanese support for the Xbox One.
Oh, you remember the image that was floating around? It was like, Japanese Xbox One launch, and it was one man outside of a store.
Yeah. That'll be launching in 2015. Please look forward to it. And Slaggy, why don't you close us out?
Yeah, there is a new Sword Art Online game in development, according to Bandai Namco. It's tentatively titled SAO3, and the game will officially be announced on October 5th at the Dengeki Bunko Fall Festival. So please look forward to more follow-ups about that.
Excellent, excellent. All right, well, with all of our follow-ups and news bits out of the way, let's start talking about the Nintendo 64.
Yes!
All right, so Slaggy, I know that you are a lifelong Nintendo fan.
Yes!
So, I'll be relying on you a lot here. But what I really want to talk about, I want to take sort of a similar tack to how we discussed the Dreamcast last week. I just want to talk a little bit, before we get into the meat and potatoes of the console itself, I want to talk about Nintendo's position at the time.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important when talking about the Nintendo 64 from a historical perspective to keep in mind, you know, that they had basically just had a hard-fought battle during the 16-bit era.
Right.
With Sega. Nintendo had plans to work with Sony for a 3D add-on for the Super Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
Those plans fell through, and so Sony began work on the PlayStation as a standalone console.
So basically Nintendo effectively killed Sega. Ha ha!
Well, you could make that argument, I suppose. But, so, what we really saw here was that Nintendo, you know, they felt the need to make a console that with, like, you know, 3D graphics that could really compete with Sega's upcoming Saturn and, you know, the Sony PlayStation that they effectively birthed in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Something I didn't realize before researching for this episode was that there was a recession in Japan at the time.
Yeah, there was. In fact, that really hit Nintendo a lot harder than Sega, because Sega's stronghold was sort of North America.
Right. And, you know, I would not say by any means that the SNES was a failure. I still think it's probably one of the best systems ever made in the history of gaming.
I think you'd have a hard time finding gamers that didn't think that.
That said, I mean, you know, it was a tough battle, like you said, with the Mega Drive / Genesis, and the mounting pressure, definitely. It was a different situation than Sega was in trying to launch the Dreamcast, but definitely, you know, still they had kind of a lot on their, lot of eyes on them.
And, you know, something that we've talked about here, and this is another really interesting little wrinkle here, is that Nintendo ended up working with Silicon Graphics to develop the chipset for the Nintendo 64. Something interesting about that chipset is that this spec was actually initially offered to Sega of America. But Sega actually refused this chipset because they wanted to be the exclusive licensor. They wanted to have a complete lockdown on this tech that Silicon Graphics was trying to, you know, make consumer-grade hardware rather than these crazy workstations that are only being used by Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically Nintendo ended up nabbing them by being more open and saying, you know, our exclusivity demand to you would only be that you don't do work with other game, like, competing game platforms.
Right.
But in terms of the non-gaming space, you can do whatever you want with this with these chips and this chipset.
Yeah, so I remember hearing about Project Reality in like,
yeah.
gaming. I don't remember which magazines. I think it might have been GamePro.
Nintendo Power talked about it too, for sure.
Yeah.
Although it was, of course, the, you know, kid-friendly, Project Reality's gonna blow your mind, guys,
yeah.
sort of Nintendo Power writing. But, you know, basically, it's sort of another way that Sega sort of dug their own grave, because the Nintendo 64's direct competitor, the Saturn, you know, that chipset was designed in-house by Sega, and it was notoriously difficult to program for.
Mm.
But in any event, you know, so we had several really interesting tech issues. We had the Silicon Graphics chipset issue that we were just talking about, you know, Project Reality and everything. But there was also a really interesting approach that Nintendo took, where they basically decided that CD technology was not appropriate for gaming applications.
Yep.
And that cartridges were the way to go. Very specifically, Peter Main, who was the vice president of marketing for Nintendo at the time, said that, you know, they weren't strictly tied to cartridges against CDs. They were for, like, direct silicon data storage over an optical storage solution. Specifically saying, you know, that as far as they're concerned, speed is the most important thing for this kind of use and application,
mm-hmm.
and you're just not going to get that from an optical media.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of you probably are thinking of not Square Enix, at the time they were still Squaresoft, but you know, this is where Final Fantasy took the leap over to Sony.
Yeah, absolutely. Because we even know for fact that before Nintendo committed to the cartridge format, that Squaresoft was working on Final Fantasy demos for the Nintendo 64.
Yep.
So something that was really interesting that Nintendo did to sort of get the Project Reality hardware
to make it a reality,
is that they worked with Midway and did like a joint sub-licensing agreement on the hardware to create two arcade games running on theoretical quote-unquote Ultra 64 hardware. And you know, the interesting thing here is that the second of the two, Killer Instinct, actually the arcade board did use the same CPU as a Nintendo 64. You know, it also had a hard drive inside, so it could stream all kinds of, you know, ridiculous quality assets.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you know, they took this chip, and for the rest of the hardware, you know, they didn't tie themselves down to Nintendo 64 strength hardware, and made Killer Instinct and Cruisin' USA.
Oh, yeah.
We talk about Killer Instinct a lot here on the show, so we maybe don't have to talk too much about it here. But I do want to talk a little bit about Cruisin' USA in the arcade.
I remember playing Cruisin' in the arcade.
Slaggy, why don't you talk...
And you probably remember Cruisin' in the arcade for Hot Boys.
Girl. I actually played Cruisin' USA a lot, as well as its sequel, Cruisin' the World.
Uh-huh.
But I want to hear from you, Slagkick. What are your experiences in the arcade with Cruisin' USA?
I mean, I definitely remember it. I remember at the time being unimpressed by the draw distance, honestly. Like, I think that's the first time I ever really noticed that. And I mean, you know,
like probably texture pop-up and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it might have also just been because, you know, 3D was really just starting to become a thing then, but I was like, why are the trees popping up, like, later on the track?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, because I think that's true for a lot of people I know. I still liked it. I played the game a lot. The arcade that I spent all my time in growing up did have a Cruisin' machine. I think all of the big arcades had Cruisin' machines and
yeah.
Killer Instinct machines. These games were huge.
I had to go to the bowling alley to play it, but anytime I was at the bowling alley, I played Cruisin'.
Yeah. And, you know, at the time, certainly, you know, the Nintendo 64 versions of these games that eventually came couldn't hold a candle to the arcade versions, because the arcade versions, while using the same CPU, were not using the same tech otherwise. So Cruisin' and Killer Instinct both, for the time, had really, like, high-resolution art assets and stuff. You know, there was all of the CGI rendered models being used in Killer Instinct. Cruisin' USA had a lot of, again, at the time, high resolution sprite work going on. And, you know, these games ultimately looked really good and got people really hyped for the Nintendo 64 as a platform.
Yeah.
So, the Nintendo 64 first released in Japan on June 23rd, 1996, alongside a set of three games. That was Pilot Wings 64, Super Mario 64, and the Japan-exclusive Saikyo Habu Shogi, which is, you know, a shogi game. The North American launch followed a few months later on September 29th, 1996, and here it launched with just two games. And that was, of course, Pilot Wings 64 and Super Mario 64.
Apparently that shogi game was a commercial flop.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, then it seems really interesting. Like, well, I'm not sure why you would launch a console with a shogi game. Like, it's not exactly like a spotlight title. Anyway, something really interesting prior to launch was that Nintendo of America chairman Howard Lincoln had basically said even then, you know, that ultimately the first party games were going to sell this system. And he had specifically had a pull quote that I saw a lot back then in all the magazines where he basically said a few great games at launch are more important than great games mixed in with a lot of dogs. So, you know, this console launched in North America with the two games, and, you know, on its first 3 days of sale, sold 350,000 out of the 500,000 units that were available. Unfortunately, over the next 4 months, it only sold an additional 150,000 units.
Aww.
George Harrison, who was the vice president of marketing at Nintendo.
And anytime I would see George Harrison's name come up in that era, I would think of the Beatle George Harrison.
Of course you would. I mean, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
He was hoping that they were going to exceed 5 million units. 1 year later. He thought by Christmas of 1997, Nintendo would have achieved 5 million units sold of the Nintendo 64.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, by the time that rolled around, they had only moved 3.6 million units. Ultimately, the Nintendo 64 ended up moving worldwide about 33 million units.
Respectable.
That was, you know, 5.5 million in Japan, 20 million in quote-unquote the Americas, and just shy of 7 million in quote-unquote other regions.
Yeah, it did fairly well over here in the Americas, by which I'm sure it means North America, because South America was probably still playing the Master System. They love Master System in Brazil. Like,
you know, the thing is, I know you're serious, and I have to laugh, but I know that, like, you could very well be right. Like, you can still buy Master Systems from that part of the world.
It's probably like, oh, Nintendo 64 pushed some units in Brazil this week, but the Master System still remains top-selling console.
Indeed. So, you know, we talked a little bit about where the Nintendo 64 came from, where it started, and when. Before we talk about the software spotlight and the legacy, I want to talk a little bit about sort of how it fared in its life. You know, generally people talk about the Nintendo 64 as if its life ended in the summer of 2001. But something that's very interesting is that the last game that was released in North America was actually Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3.
I remember that.
Which released in August 20th of 2002. Strangely enough, that was 9 months after the PlayStation 2 version of that game release. So Slaggy, I want to talk about this based on memory. You know, I think when people talk about the Nintendo 64, it's generally viewed as a failure. But, you know, as we were just saying in terms of total sales, like, you could do a heck of a lot worse than 33 million worldwide.
It was more successful than the GameCube was.
Ask Sega. Oh, yeah, that's definitely an angle that's true.
And, you know, eventually one of these days, I'm sure we'll do a spotlight on the GameCube. And I love the GameCube, but...
I mean, GameCube.
It might just be that, you know, it did push 20-plus million units in the Americas. So, I mean, I remember it, you know... I know I had friends who talked about PlayStation, but I think a lot more of my friends were way more into N64.
Yeah, and you know, something I wanna talk about real quick, and I realize, of course, we're looking at this from the perspective of being Nintendo fans, but, you know, while the Nintendo 64 did have comparatively fewer games than the PlayStation...
Yep, 387 games.
I do think it's worth mentioning, you know, not only were there a lot of real jewels for the Nintendo 64,
mm-hmm.
You know, just go to any website where hardcore gamers congregate and talk about GoldenEye 007... but I really think it's interesting to think about how many of Nintendo's first-party games sort of are still alive and thriving and have huge fan bases now. You know, you have stuff like Smash Brothers was born in this era.
Mm-hmm.
Mario Party was born in this era. So, you know, there's definitely some real love for the games that were on the Nintendo 64, which is why we're talking about it.
And, you know, one thing that I always found interesting is that compared to a lot of other systems, it had pretty strong Western support. I mean, one thing that's notable about the N64 is that there were not that many Japanese exclusive games. I mean, there were a handful of them, like the Shogi game and stuff, but there were also a lot of Western exclusive games, like at least a couple dozen.
Which, when you only have some 300 games, is actually a lot.
And, you know, as you were saying, the ones that we did get are gems. I mean, when you look at the Nintendo 64, you really have to look at some of the advancements. I mean, a lot of people will look at the graphics, but I mean, in terms of game design, especially with Nintendo's first-party games, how much they just took a leap forward.
Well, I mean, you know, all that really needs to be said is that, you know, not only were there a lot of incredible games, a lot of new franchises born, but even stuff like Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. Like, that's generally considered one of the best games
right.
ever.
I mean, and when you look at the Zelda and the Mario series, two flagship Nintendo series considered, you know, many people, you know, many people considered it at least then, maybe it'd be argued now that there were other flagship series.
I was gonna say, yeah, I don't think Zelda even ranks as flagship
anymore. I know,
anymore.
But
you're looking at, like, Animal Crossing, and Pokemon. And
right, which Animal Crossing made its debut in Japan on the 64.
Well, absolutely. Like, and that's a great point,
yeah.
Really.
But, you know, I really always go back to Ocarina of Time, like you said, in Super Mario 64. And when you compare them to their predecessors, Super Mario World and A Link to the Past, I mean, you know, also both classic games, two of the best gems ever in gaming, two of the best titles on the Super Famicom with, you know, no debate. But, I mean, just the leap in, you know, game design and ideas and, you know, I mean, Mario 64 basically changed the way that platforming games worked.
Yeah, and you know, I certainly would argue that it was the first successful 3D platforming game.
Uh-huh.
So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, for the software spotlight on the Dreamcast that we did for our Dreamcast episode, we set out to list 10 games, and we end up going over with 13 or 14, I think. I set a similar goal of 10 here, and we have once again ended up with more.
Yeah, and you didn't include Ocarina because I know you don't like Zelda.
Yeah, I don't really want to waste a lot of time talking about Zelda. But if you do, you have my permission to talk about Zelda. But I want to start, of course, we talked just now about Mario 64. It was a landmark work, both for Nintendo and among the entire industry. I think that everyone making 3D platforming games was inspired and informed by Mario 64 in terms of how to communicate to a player in a 3D space, about, you know, how to design 3D spaces to explore and interact. I'm hard-pressed to say a bad thing about Mario 64,
it was just
knowing what
joy.
I know now.
And I mean, for those of us at the time, having never really experienced anything like this, and, you know, having so much love for the 2D Mario games, you know, I mean, we didn't know anything besides 2D for, you know, the longest time. And I think just that it was able to capture the joy of playing a Mario game, but just in a whole different way. It just, like, I can't really think of many other gaming experiences in my life than the first time I played Mario 64. Like, it blew me away. It really did.
Yeah. Just absolutely incredible experience.
I think, like, you know, that's one of the times that I was like, oh, it's the future of gaming.
Well, talking about Mario 64 and the first time I played it, it is a little bit like talking about the first time I heard the Beatles. It's just like, it completely changed my perception of games. You know, my personal first time playing Super Mario 64 was a demo unit in Toys R Us with Seawolf Jason, because we heard they had gotten their demo unit, and, you know, we didn't have N64s yet. So we went there, and we played this game probably every day for a solid month.
Wow.
Because it was just clear after the first time I played it that I had never played anything like this, but it was clear that this was what games were going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a moment of sea change and seeing it happen and knowing it would happen. And, you know, something interesting to me about Mario 64, and I don't know if this is nostalgia goggles or not, but I still really, really enjoy playing Mario 64.
Right.
You know, I have Mario 64 on the Wii Virtual Console. Unfortunately, it's not available on the Wii U Virtual
right.
Console yet.
I want to play it on my gamepad so bad.
Yeah, me too, seriously. But I just really enjoy playing it. Even still, anytime I'm just looking for a chill afternoon day, anytime I'm looking a game on just a chill afternoon day, Mario 64 is just the easiest game to put on and just jump into a painting and just relax and have a good day.
And I mean, I think that the appeal of it is so enduring that, you know, it's really what we see to this day. The basic idea is carried forth in Sunshine, in Galaxy, and, you know, even things like 3D World and whatever is next in store. I mean, this is, it launched an entire new, you know, for a while we thought that, oh, this is Mario going forward. And now, you know, we've seen a return of the
2D,
but this is not our Mario episode.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a Mario episode someday.
We'll have to do a Mario month.
But, yeah, just, I mean, we could probably do a whole episode just on Mario 64.
Right.
The level designs are still great. There's really great attention to detail, even for the time. A lot of really cool side objectives and bonuses.
Not being super linear was a very different thing.
It wasn't that different. That already existed in a lot of ways in Mario 3 and Mario World.
To an extent, but I mean, I think it just took a further step into that idea.
Well, yeah, but I mean, anyway, I don't want to get too far deterred.
Mario 64, classic.
Yeah, absolute classic.
And you know, something that people might not remember or have even known before is that Ocarina of Time actually used, you know, as its basis, the Mario 64 engine, but then they ended up modifying it. So at the end, it was like almost an entirely different engine, but it's really interesting to think that they came from the same engine originally.
So the next game I wanted to talk about was similarly defining. This was, of course, the first successful attempt at doing a console-exclusive first-person shooter. I'm talking, of course, about GoldenEye 007.
Yep, which we talked about a bit in our Rareware episode.
We did. And, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but like we said then and still say, you know, this was the game that made first-person shooters work.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny in retrospect that it was a Nintendo console exclusive.
Right.
But really, this was just one of those rare instances where everything about the game design came together and it became more than the sum of its parts. Another game I would say that about, that we also talked about during our Rare episode, would be Banjo-Kazooie.
Yeah, I mean, really, one of the only other games really on the caliber of Mario 64 in terms of, you know, 3D adventuring and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's funny to think, you know, between Mario 64 and Banjo-Kazooie, I think most people who are interested in, like, 3D platformers would agree that these two games basically set the stage for what this genre is. And I think games to this day still follow the conventions set by these two games.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And, you know, I know you aren't including Zelda, but I guess we'll talk about Zelda one other day.
Well, what do you mean contextually here? Where does Zelda come into play in what you're saying right now?
I mean, I think a lot of games tried to ape what Zelda was doing with Ocarina of Time.
So you just generally mean that you think Zelda set the conventions for a certain kind of 3D game? Like, give me context. What are you going towards here?
That's all. You know, I would say you hit the nail on the head there.
Okay. You know, another game that I think when we're going to sort of start getting toward things that are a little weirder now, because, you know, this is Game Buoy, and it's certainly not game-defining Game Buoy. Oh, I guess it kind of is. I want to talk about Mystical Ninja starring Goemon.
Yeah.
This was, of course, released in Japan as Ganbare Goemon, Neo Momoyama, Bakufuku no Odori.
Whoa, that's a mouthful.
Go for it, Goemon, Dance of the Neo Peach Mountain Shogunate. So this is described as a platform adventure game. It was released by Konami in 1997 in Japan and 1998 in North America. It is the fifth entry in the Ganbare Goemon series. And this game, I actually like it a lot more than I like something like Zelda. It plays similarly to like a mixture of Mario 64 and Zelda. It has like a sort of the Zelda adventure angle and like using a sword. But it also has like Mario 64 style platforming. So it's if you've never played it, it's very similar to the best of both of those games. But, you know, it's a Konami game. It's not a Nintendo game. So it is lacking a bit in terms of polish.
Mm-hmm.
But the game, it's really funny. It's practically a comedy. Like it has a laugh track, like sound clip that it plays at certain points in the game. And it just has multiple playable characters, all with different abilities. It had, like, a mini-game that was, like, a giant robot rhythm game. Yeah, it was just a really great game.
And isn't this the game where in the Japanese version, there were hentai magazines that were, collectible?
That is probably true, but I think that's true for several Goemon games.
Yeah, the Goemon games are pretty wacky. I remember, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time with Mystical Ninja starring Goemon, but, you know, I remember thinking similarly about the jump from the Super Nintendo version to the N64 version.
Yeah, well, again, you know.
Seeing, like, the ideas that were successfully executed in 2D evolving into 3D. And I think more so than any other early 3D console, we see most of these happening with Nintendo, really.
Okay, I can see that.
What I'm saying is Nintendo, I think it was most successful. Nintendo 64 was the most successful in, you know, adapting 2D ideas to a 3D sphere.
Okay, I can see what you're saying. Something that is really interesting about this game is that it had a lot of voice samples. It had three musical numbers that had, like, vocals that were, like, wholly sung and had, like, karaoke-style lyrics in the bottom of the screen during them. it was very much like a Japanese game. It was super well done. It actually had a larger cartridge size than most Nintendo 64 games of the time, weighing in at 128 megabits, which I certainly couldn't tell you what that is in terms of bytes. Probably not very many, but you know. It's actually a huge part of that space in the cartridge was dedicated just to the voice samples and the vocals for the songs. And, you know, this is actually, to date, one of the more popular soundtracks that you'll see on a lot of, like, the video game soundtrack download sites. Like, you'll often see...
Well, I mean, people really love Goemon music.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like,
well,
not just for this game, but...
Well, in this game specifically, there was, like, a very intentional, like, integration of, like, pop stylings as well as, like, traditional Japanese folk music. And so you would have, like, vocal songs that have, like, pop vocals, but with straight up, like, shamisen
like Enka
arrangements. Music. Yeah, absolutely, exactly. You know, I could actually go on all day about Mystical Ninja starring Goemon. I still have a cart of it. I'm a huge fan of this game. If you are looking at getting into Nintendo 64 gaming and you haven't played Mystical Ninja starring Goemon, I would put that at the very top of your list of games that you should be looking into.
Yeah, it's one that people maybe wouldn't think to look at, but definitely a fun one.
Another game that I want to talk about is one that was much maligned pre-release. This is Bomberman 64. And, you know, this was, again, it was a 3D reinterpretation of a traditional 2D game design, released in 1997. And a lot of people initially were very concerned that they were changing the game design from being, you know, a grid-based sprite 2D game design with very defined, like, blast radiuses for your bombs. For those of you who aren't familiar with Bomberman, the general conceit is that you control a cute little super deformed guy who can drop bombs. After a set amount of time, they explode, and you want your enemies to be in the blast radius while you're not.
Yeah.
On the grid space, this was, of course, very easy to see and read as a player. You drop a bomb, and you know that if your blast radius is 2 squares, you need to be more than 2 squares away. Bomberman 64 definitely utilized being a 3D game by adding, like, multiple tiers of, like, height for the game design, and your bombs, rather than blowing up in straight lines, as it did on the grid, they were fully formed 3D spheres that would explode outward as well as upward and downward in 3D space. A core part of the Bomberman design, generally, is to its multiplayer modes. And, you know, we've talked about Bomberman here on the show in bits and pieces. Bomberman would be an interesting spotlight episode.
It would.
Anyway, so, you know, really, a lot of people had a lot of concerns that, you know, this was a game that didn't need to be in 3D. This game didn't need to get this kind of translation. They should have just done a multiplayer 2D Bomberman. But when the game came out and it had a whole, like, single-player mode with, like, a whole game world done in, like, an adventure-style game,
yeah,
people ended up enjoying that. But what they enjoyed even more was actually the multiplayer, you know, which a lot of people thought was going to be problematic, turned out to be really, really great.
I had a lot of fun with multiplayer.
Oh, absolutely. I pretty much everyone I know did. Even people I knew who weren't gamers and would never have played 2D Bomberman would come over to my house. Literally every night we had Bomberman 64 parties for more than a year.
Wow.
Where non-gamers would come over and wait patiently for their turn to play because it was just so fun. You know, and strangely enough, you know, a lot of people thought it was going to be problematic, but it turned out that the whole 3D gimmick actually worked really well. Explosions going in spheres, so you could throw a powered up bomb that had, you know, a large enough blast radius, like, oh man, this blast on the second tier is gonna be so big it's even gonna hit me on the first tier. I need to get out of here. Like, it added a whole strategic element that really worked for people. And I wanted to bring this up in this conversation because this is a game that people who never played it maybe don't realize the game actually worked out really well. It turned out to be a really complete game that people really loved, and it ended up getting two sequels, Bomberman Hero and Bomberman 64 2, the second attack in North America. And this is a game, I could really talk about this game all day and night. Unfortunately, I don't have a cartridge of it anymore, and they're in high demand because while the Nintendo 64 is generally well emulated, for some reason, Bomberman 64 emulates very, very poorly.
Mm.
So again, this is another game, much like Mystical Ninja starring Goemon. If you're interested in getting into Nintendo 64 gaming now, that's one you're going to want, and I just hope you're going to be able to find a copy for a reasonable price. The next game I want to talk about here was published by Enix in association with Nintendo. This was a game developed by Treasure called Mischief Makers. It was known in Japan as Yuki Yuki Troublemakers. It's a side-scrolling platform game using pre-rendered sprites.
Yeah, Marina. Sorry, that was the name of the little robot maid.
So this game has basically everything you could want out of a Treasure game, which probably will tell you in a single phrase whether this is a game you're interested in playing or not. Unfortunately, it's never gotten any kind of re-release. It's not emulated anywhere. My understanding is it can be emulated on PC, so, you know, that's something to keep in mind, I suppose. But a lot of the signatures of Treasure's style of game design do come into play here. The characters are all very expressive in their animations. It has really great sound design with a lot of really great, like, voice clips. It has a really interesting game mechanic where Marina, your robo-maid, can, like, catch items and then shake them and throw them. That sounds a little silly, but when you shake things, like if you shake a bomb, it might make the bomb get bigger so that it will explode bigger when you throw it. Sometimes there will be boxes that you'll shake and items will come out, or enemies that need to be shaken to get dizzy and then you can throw them. So it had, you know, this really strange gimmick, and it had a lot of really super interesting and well-designed but difficult boss fights. And, you know, this is to the point now where when this game comes out in conversation now among people who know, this is largely considered, like, the most underrated game on the Nintendo 64 platform. Unlike most of Treasure's previous games, because, you know, most of them were about, like, shooting and direct combat with the enemy, this game was more about exploration and puzzle solving. Every stage had a certain amount of items you had to collect in order to get, like, the best ending. And in order to find all the items, you would have to pretty much grab and shake everything. And, you know, so it was a very cool game. You had double jumps, you had some really weird, like, mini games based around, like, riding a motorcycle. And this was another game that had a lot of comic relief, you know, much like the Goemon game we were talking about a little bit ago. This was another game that had, like, a lot of real, like, humor and silliness in its script and its design and its scenario to some degree. So, you know, it's again a real treasure, no pun intended. And I think it's really underappreciated. If you have a Nintendo 64 or you want to get into Nintendo 64, I highly, highly, highly recommend that you take a look into this game.
Up next, I believe we talked a bit about this in our Rare episode, and that, of course, is Jet Force Gemini, which is a third-person shooter from Rare. It came out in 1999, kind of in the last quarter of 1999 in the various regions, and you're playing as the three members of Jet Force Gemini.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked a little bit about Jet Force Gemini during our Rare episode, so I don't want to talk too much about it here. But again, you know, this is a game that I think a lot of people didn't play just because of when it released. You know, releasing toward the end of 1999, we already had the Dreamcast out in stores. People were looking at the specter of the PlayStation 2 coming up with its brain controls and Final Fantasy CGI graphics. So most people I know who are real Nintendo 64 fans haven't played Jet Force Gemini. So this is one, you know, it's really cool, third-person shooter. It's actually, like, a very, like, violent game. It had some cool multiplayer stuff going on in terms of, like, death matching, but it was not, like, co-op for the, the campaign. So that was actually not expected. Most people thought this game was gonna be co-op all the way through. Turned out to be the co-op stuff, or the multiplayer stuff would be deathmatch. But, you know, again, it was a very cool game. Had a lot of, like, weapon upgrading, a lot of exploration. We talked about why this game was awesome during our Rare episode, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So I would definitely recommend you look into this if you haven't played it. I believe you can emulate it, and I've seen copies of it in stores for pretty reasonable amounts. But we'll talk a little bit about getting into buying this stuff toward the end of the episode. So the next game we'll want to talk about, Slackick, I think this is one you probably have a lot to say.
Oh, yes.
But I want to talk about Mario Party.
Oh!
Slackick, why don't you tell us about Mario Party?
With Mario Party, you have to mash the analog stick with your palm, and then you hate it forever. Now, Mario Party is basically, it takes the conceit of a board game, and you hop around the game board and roll a dice and try to collect coins and stars.
Game board, grinding on that stick, grinding on that stick.
What all of us keep coming back to the Mario Party franchise for are the mini games. And these are, you know, just silly little short games. Varying kinds of multiplayer. Some are everyone competing against each other. Some are 1v3. Some are 2v2. So really, you know, for the first time, one of my first memories with, like, asynchronous multiplayer.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I think my first Mario Party that I had real memories with was Mario Party 2 for the N64. But, you know, this is another example of a franchise that still does well to this day. I mean, it's not the top-selling Mario franchise, but, you know, they still keep putting out games. We've got one in development for Wii U. And it was successful enough to the point where Sega put out Sonic Shuffle. And I think there were even some other copycat games. There was a Crash one, right?
I believe there was a Crash Party game.
So that, you know, that the idea of, like, a party games sort of thing was a thing. And, you know, like I said, a lot of us think about, like, oh, spin the analog stick around as fast as you can.
Well, you just made that joke, bro.
No, I know. I was calling back to it. But, you know, a lot of us probably have similar memories to something like that. Do you have a favorite Mario Party minigame?
Not really. I generally like any minigame that's, like, oh, you're going to be on a platform, and the other platforms are going to fall, so you better be on one that doesn't fall.
Oh, of course you like that one.
Yeah, because they're really competitive, and you can push people off the platforms. I'm into that.
Yeah. I liked the Toad's Bandstand from Mario Party 2.
Oh, was that the vaguely rhythm gamey one?
Yeah, it's like, do-do-do, do-do-do-do, and then you had to be like, boom, 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 boom. You know, that's totally the technical way to describe it. But yeah, it was vague. Like, so, I mean, there were some really clever ideas, like rhythm games, and, you know, some were, like, coin collecting games, some were little, like, carnival style, like, you know, like, knock 'em down games. Just a lot of really clever little, ideas explored. I mean, and I really think that, you know, I had mentioned, did I mention Wii Party yet?
I don't believe you did.
Wii Party, but, you know, even Nintendo Land, I think, really takes a lot of its conceit from Mario Party, so.
Absolutely.
Just, you know, a very enduring idea, and still, like, the nice thing about Mario Party is that you can pull out any Mario Party game and have fun with it. Because, you know, they do borrow some of these ideas throughout the games, but, you know, it's always going to be a different mix of minigames. So
yeah,
always a ton of fun.
And you know, something interesting about the first Mario Party is that it was scheduled to be released for a virtual console, but Nintendo has actually acknowledged that they ended up not releasing it on virtual console for the Wii because it was responsible for, you know, many people getting injured and breaking many people's controllers, that they didn't want that to happen to people's Wii controllers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I believe Mario Party 3 is on the Virtual Console. One of the games
one
is,
of
but,
them
it's
is.
Not, but it's
two
not
or
one.
Three.
Yeah, you're right. That was Mario Party 2 is available on Virtual Console, which, you know, as you were saying, the Mario Party games are all pretty similar to each other. So definitely if you want to play Mario Party, I would definitely recommend you take a look at the original Wii Virtual Console. You can grab Mario Party 2 and, you know, get at it.
Yeah, you know, and I was just reading right now about, apparently they gave away Mario Party gloves so that people wouldn't get blisters from the analog stick.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was a class action suit about that.
Yeah, and then that we didn't get any stick spinning games until Island Tour because, you know, of course the 3DS analog stick
has the slide pad.
Has a slide pad. But anyways, blisters and all, Mario Party, good time.
Excellent, excellent. You know, the next game I want to talk about here is Super Smash Brothers.
Yes!
I don't want to talk too much about this game because I might be planning a little something for when Smash Brothers comes out, for when Smash Brothers 4 comes out for Wii U.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of course, it's Smash Brothers. We talk about this game literally every episode of this show. And, you know, this is a game that started on the Nintendo 64 and couldn't have really been done the way it is on any previous console. So, you know, that's something that's very exciting. That Nintendo really took advantage of not just the 3D graphics, because, you know, this game could have been done with sprites. It would have been all right. But it was actually a big part of this game's success was that it was a four-player game, and the Nintendo 64 had four controller ports. So this and Mario Party, as you were saying, you know, is actually a big deal that you could just have four people over and play these games. And even people who weren't like hardcore gamers or whatever could just hop right in on these things. So Smash Brothers in particular really, really, really benefited from that.
And you know, one thing that Smash Brothers, I mean, I guess at this point, most of us are really familiar with Nintendo's wide variety of series, but I remember Smash Brothers, a lot of people like becoming aware of NES for the first time, and we later saw that with Ike for Fire Emblem, so a lot of people becoming familiar with some of these more obscure games or series through Smash.
Oh, that's definitely true, and in fact, you know, I'm pretty sure Nintendo has said on record that a big part of why they ended up giving Fire Emblem a chance when they started bringing the GBA games over is because of Marth's popularity in the Smash Brothers Melee game.
Oh, right, Marth came first.
So, you know, it definitely, definitely true. Earthbound was, you know, a lesser known, but a big part of, I think, its ongoing fanaticism really does relate to how strong of a reaction people had to the character Ness when he unlocked in that first Smash Brothers game.
Oh, man, Ness was a powerhououse.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and he still is.
He still is, but I mean, when you think of it, like, back then, Ness really, because I remember a lot of people feeling similarly about Mewtwo and Melee, but I'm like, oh, we could just talk about Smash forever, but
and we're probably going to at some point.
You know, I mean, a lot of the, you know, much beloved characters in Smash, Captain Falcon, I love Falcon, but Jigglypuff, Kirby, Ness, Pikachu, I know a lot of people are Pika fans. Samus has a pretty big following, from what I'm aware of. You know, we're part of this original roster, to the point where, like, if they were not included in a game, people would probably have lost their S.
Yeah. You know, the next game I want to talk about, and we're going to come back to the Smash Brothers topic in a future episode. I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah.
But if you're interested in playing the original Nintendo 64 Smash game, it is very emulatable, but rather than emulate it, you should go buy it for the Wii Virtual Console.
Yes, you should.
That's definitely something that, you know, it's helpful to have continued support for these games, and it's worth the money. It's just, it's a really great game. Anyway, the next game I want to talk about is F-Zero X. And this, for me, is actually my favorite F-Zero game. I know a lot of people prefer F-Zero GX or AX. which respectively is the GameCube version and the arcade version. But my favorite was definitely F-Zero X for the Nintendo 64. This was four players. You could play against each other in like a death race. But something that's really fascinating to me about this game from a tech perspective...
60 frames per second?
...is that this game ran at a locked 60 frames per second, even with all 30 vehicles in your race on screen at a time. You know, of course, in order to achieve that, the actual models of the machine, of your racing machines are very low. The track detail is very low. A lot of the tech polygon textures quality is very low.
Yep, but that 60 frames per second.
But it feels so good because of that 60 frames
per
second.
Well, I mean, a game like F-Zero where it's fast, that would make or break it, really.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's controls
1080p,
60
frames per second, more like 320 by 240, 50 frames per second. No, but you're right. I mean, I think that the sacrificing the graphical detail was a smart choice.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That feeling of speed in this game is second to none, and at the time when I played it, it was unlike anything, really. And, you know, also as a cute little aside, it had a rainbow road in it.
Aww.
It was called the psychedelic experience in-game.
You know, when you were saying F-Zero X, I thought of F-O-X, and I noticed that Star Fox 64 isn't on this list. And I guess one thing to consider about Star Fox 64, I just want to talk about it for just a minute, is, you know, that Star Fox, the original game, already really pushed the boundaries of the Super Nintendo, so, you know, it basically was, you know, already a 3D game.
But... You know, I love Star Fox 64.
Do a barrel roll!
If I were doing a favorite games of all time, it would definitely be a top 10 game for me. I think its design is incredibly tight. I think it, visually, for the time, was breathtaking. I'm one of those weirdos that played every level over and over until I had, like, the super secret gold medal on every stage. I unlocked, like, Landmaster mode for Versus, and I unlocked, like, giant mecha robot, like, Star Fox team members. I loved that game. The only reason it's not on this list is because, as you say, it's an incredible game, but it's a game that just got a port on 3DS a year, you know, 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And while it is, in my opinion, the perfection of all of the game design elements that were present in the Super Nintendo release of Star Fox, the downside to that is that it really is more of an iteration of the formula than an evolution of the formula.
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting little tidbit of Star Fox 2 being almost complete but then canceled.
Well, for Star Fox 64, we've actually talked about that here on the show.
Yeah, we did. But, you know, I wanted to take a minute, because when you said F-Zero-X, I'm like, oh, F-O-X.
LOL.
Apparently, there was a promotional video that Nintendo Power subscribers received, where a Sony agent and a Sega agent were torturing a Mario doll to try to get information about the upcoming Star Fox 4 release. Did you have this?
I did, yeah.
Was it ridiculously cheesy?
Yes.
I bet you could find it on YouTube.
It was embarrassing even then.
So many of these promotional videos were.
So back to F-Zero X. If you're interested in playing this, it did get a virtual console release on the original Wii back in 2007.
Oh.
And it performs beautifully, and you know, if you're running your Wii through component cables, or you're playing on a Wii U in Wii mode via HDMI, while this game, you know, as we've talked about, the in-game assets are of fairly low quality, the game running in 60 frames a second is actually still a sight to behold.
Yeah,
like,
it's
quite
looks something
crazy. So that's definitely something you'll want to look into if you're interested in the F-Zero series, but you haven't really explored it. The next game I want to talk about is, most people view it as a joke, but I want to talk about Quest 64. And this is a game that was hated. And, you know, I say that, and I'm sure that people think I'm over-exaggerating, but no. There is real, like, spite and ire for this game out there in video game fandom. And to be honest with you, I've never understood why. The game actually had, like, a really cool, like, magic and leveling system, which was something that I actually really liked. You know, it was really strange. It didn't have, like, stores or shops or whatever. It had a very basic story, which I think is probably why people didn't really like it that much. Because its story was not Final Fantasy caliber. Like, its story wasn't Final Fantasy Mystic Quest caliber. Its story wasn't Paladin's Quest caliber. But it did have a cool leveling system. The way the magic system worked was really cool. And, you know, the graphics for its time were actually not bad. The box art was effing atrocious, but that's all right. That's not too uncommon.
I seem to remember reading that the Japanese version had had some alterations made because, it was a little bit easy, a little short. They kind of tightened up the gameplay, added some new challenges, and that one reason that a lot of, people in Nintendo thought that the N64 was not selling well in Japan was it didn't have any, JRPGs. That it didn't have really any RPGs.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember a lot of people talking about that at the time. How it was going to be the only RPG because, the Nintendo 64 needed RPGs and had none.
Well, I mean, they lost Dragon Warrior and Final Fantasy, so that's two big hits.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I knew you were gonna. But anyway, this game came out in North America before Japan, actually. We got it more than a year early. Something that I always thought was really cool about the game was that you would get, instead of leveling up via, XP and stuff, you would get specific stats for, how you fought. Like, very similar to the Final Fantasy II method of leveling. But you would get all of your abilities by leveling individual elements. Like, you would have fire, earth, water, and wind. And when you would get, level up elements, you would pick which one to increase.
Wait, was this Avatar?
Right, though. And increasing an element would give you new attacks and make your other attacks more strong. And so for me, I really like the fire one, so I'd always put my points in fire whenever it would let me. And it just felt really like there was a lot of customization going, which is something that I really enjoy in a leveling system. So, Quest 64, it's probably safe to call it a bad game, but it's a bad game that I think is undeservedly hated, and that I think is worth playing through once.
Aww.
So, unfortunately, it's never been available or re-released in any context. At the time, I remember the people referring to the game as a success. I believe it is emulated, and you can find carts of it on the secondhand marketplace pretty cheap. I've seen copies of it on eBay for under $10. So, if you want to check it out for under $10, I think you could do a heck of a lot worse. The next game I want to briefly, in fact, actually the next three games we're just going to talk about real briefly, because we've discussed them in a recent episode. That is, of course, Snowboard Kids, Mario Kart 64, and Diddy Kong Racing.
Yes.
And these three games, between the three of them, are really the games that defined, most gamers, and I think for most developers, what kart racing games could and should be like. Slaggy, do you have anything to say about those three games that we haven't said recently?
No, just that, I never viewed any of them as, being pet. I mean, Mario Kart 64 would probably take the crown, because it's Mario Kart, but, I think there's value in playing all three of them. They're all equally fun experiences.
Excellent, excellent. Your best bet to play Snowboard Kids would probably be via the DS port that it got, for the DS. Mario Kart 64 is available on the Wii Shop as a virtual console title. And Diddy Kong Racing also got a DS port / remake.
That's
so you can play that there. This was the little list I assembled. Sidekick, were there any games you wanted to talk about? I know you called out Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time. You called out Star Fox 64. What else? What other games do you have strong feelings about for the Nintendo 64 platform?
I feel like Kirby 64 The Crystal Shards doesn't get as much attention. And I mean, I know a lot of people thought it was kind of, maybe not a far enough step forward, or in some ways maybe even a step backwards. But I thought the combo system was pretty neat. And I thought that it was cool that it was kind of it was really a 2.5D platformer. And I think a lot of people were expecting maybe, a full 3D platformer Kirby, but that wouldn't feel right to me for Kirby, really.
I actually agree with you. I think Crystal Shards was a great game, lots of fun. I thought that the level designs were great, and I thought that 2.5D was a great choice for Kirby.
And this is available on Virtual Console, I believe, just for Wii. I don't think it has a Wii U one yet.
And was that in that Kirby
Anniversary
collection?
I'm looking at your beautiful beautiful poster over there.
Excellent.
Man, we haven't done a Kirby Buoy, have we?
You know, we haven't, but it's on the list.
Kirby Buoy.
Kirby Buoy.
But you know, Captain Spike, you really mentioned, I think, the ones that most people think of. Did we talk a lot about Mega Man 64 in our...
Well, you know, we didn't. We mentioned it exists, because, you know, that's just a port of Mega Man Legends.
Right.
And it's not really, like, a particularly enhanced port. So, I mean, you know, everything we said about Mega Man Legends applies there.
Mm-hmm. The N64 actually had a fair share of games for... The N64 actually had a fair share of sports games.
It did, yeah.
And, you know, there were a couple stinkers, like Paperboy 64, I thought was not super great. But, you know, overall, I think of the N64 as a very successful console with a lot of great games, like Paper Mario.
Oh, yeah, that's a great, you know, and that's another series that was born on Nintendo 64.
Yeah, I mean, you could
argue... That is a very popular series today.
You could argue that it was really born on the Super Famicom with Mario RPG, but... That said, I mean, really, Paper Mario is its own game.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, but at the same time, you know, Paper Mario and Mario RPG coexist in this day and age. Some of the games that come out here as Paper Mario games in Japan are released as Mario RPG games. You know, so you could probably make that argument.
Yeah, and I seem to remember you talking about a Neon Genesis Evangelion game for N64.
Oh yeah, you know that's great. I think it's a really cool game. It's almost like a mini game with various mini games taking the place of like some sort of interesting episodes. Like the Both of You Dance Like You Want to Win episode is a rhythm game. Some of the angels that were villainous are just straight up like action, like fighting games. Not super, super well designed, but just like really neat concepts that they really, really tried to go all the way with. You know, and there, now that you're mentioning some of these games, I'm like, man, you know, we did this episode, we haven't talked about Wave Race 64 yet.
Wait, how did you not talk about Wave Race 64?
Right? We didn't talk about the Star Wars Shadows of the Empire game, which was a huge deal at the time. We didn't even talk about the actual version of Killer Instinct that released on the Nintendo 64.
There
Killer
was
Instinct
Yoshi's
Gold.
Story.
Yoshi's Story, yeah. Of course, there were all kinds of, like, really weird and sometimes unpleasant games, like War Gods and Dark Rift. One of my personal favorites, Blast Corps. So, yeah, I mean, just this game, this console is so underappreciated. There are a lot of really great games that appeared for it, a lot of them exclusive that didn't pop up anywhere else for some reason.
Yeah, there's a couple more that I'm specifically not talking about right now because they kind of tie into accessories.
Oh, yeah, and we are, you know, well, why don't we move on then?
Oh, don't you remember Clay Fighter 63 and a third?
Oh, I most absolutely do. I effing love the Clay Fighters games.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, there were the amazing, in my opinion, Castlevania games. You know, Castlevania 64, of course, is a very tense topic among the Castlevania fandom. But as you may recall, during our Castlevania episode a year ago, I'm a big fan of Castlevania 64. I think that both of the Castlevania 64 games are very ambitious attempts at something that I think still Konami hasn't really gotten right, which is, of course, moving Castlevania's game design into a 3D space.
Yeah. So, and, you know, we mentioned that there were only, like, what, 387 games, but, you know, the larger the software library is, the more shovelware you end up with. So, I mean, really, you know, even though there were some stinkers in...
Man, now I'm,
like,
see, now I'm stuck 64. On, like, you know, I talked about a lot of really great games that are underappreciated, but I didn't talk about Ogre Battle 64.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't talk about Sin and Punishment, you know, another amazing treasure game. So, yeah, no, I think that the Nintendo 64's software library is superb and deeply underappreciated.
Yeah. And did you know that Clay Fighter 63 and the Third had, like, an all-star voice acting cast?
I did not.
Like, we're talking, like, Jim Cummings, Tress McNeil, Dan Castellaneta, like, all-star of the 90s, like, basically, like, you know, Simpsons, Animaniacs, voice actors, like, super high profile.
All right. Well, why don't we...
Oh, yeah, we already talked about Conker's Bad Fur Day, but, you know, just mentioning it again here.
Yeah. Well, you know, why don't we get this discussion moving forward and start wrapping up? Why don't we talk about sort of this console's tech aspects? Some of the add-ons it had, and some of the ways that the tech design choices for the console, really do persist today in what
yeah.
is important about console and hardware design. So, You know, talking about the tech legacy aspect of the Nintendo 64, I think there are probably three, like, must-hit talking points right out of the gate. The first one, of course, is as plain as the nose on my face. I am talking about the analog stick on the controller.
Oh, yeah. The analog stick that would sometimes get stuck.
I never had that issue.
I did one on one controller.
But, you know, it was actually a big deal for the stock controller with the console to have an analog stick. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of people didn't even understand the concept of an analog controller.
Oh, I took to it right away.
Oh, absolutely. And you look at something like Mario 64, where Mario has, you know, different run speeds based on how far you press the stick. For a lot of us, it was very intuitive once we were using it. But I remember during the pre-release hype phase of the console, a lot of people had a really difficult time wrapping their head around it.
Or wrapping their hands around it.
But, you know, ultimately now, I can't imagine a non-analog controller any console. When portable platforms hit that don't have analog sticks, people wig out. Like, what? You need analog. Hello.
Right. And, you know, I know we were having this conversation playing Mario Kart 8 a few months ago, and about how you still use the, you know, the D-pad for it. And I can't really imagine many games where I wouldn't be using an analog stick at this point. So...
Yeah, and you know, I really do think that you are definitely a more representative example in this instance, because, you know, I use the D-pad on Mario Kart 8 simply because I like where it's positioned, and it's comfy for me, and I do fine with it. But, you know, I even agree, like, analog support is by far the best for basically every game genre.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I don't even know that we have to talk about it too much, because if you're listening to this show, you probably held a controller in your hand before. You've probably held an analog stick in your hand before. You probably like analog sticks. So go ahead.
If you don't want hashtag GameBooey Extra, do you not like analog sticks?
All right.
Why?
That was the Nintendo 64 that brought that to every controller on a console. You know, we quickly saw that adapted by Sony. They did analog sticks.
And you look at all the DualShocks these days now. I mean, before I had a PlayStation controller that was just digital, and it was basic.
You know, and I do have to say, the Saturn also had an analog controller, and it did release in the same window. So I'm not going to say that Nintendo 64 had the first analog stick.
But who had a Saturn besides you?
Not where I was going with that, but that also applies. But I do think it's important that the Saturn analog stick was something you had to buy with Knights, whereas the Nintendo 64 just came with it stock. You had to have it if you had the console. On a related note, you know, it's also why I think it's very important that Nintendo 64 had four controller ports. You know, I touched on this briefly when we talked about Smash Brothers, but while we did have games dating back to the NES that took use of, you know, the NES 4Score / the NES Satellite that supported four players, you know, the Super Nintendo had the multi-tap that such games as Secret of Mana, Super Bomberman, I'm sorry. You know, these games would allow up to five, in some instances, players play at a time. The PlayStation 1 had a multi-tap style adapter. But ultimately, really, to me, it's such a huge game-changing deal that the Nintendo 64 had four controller ports.
Yep, and then, you know,
the Dreamcast shortly followed after that. Yep. Well, the PlayStation 2 didn't.
No, and the Xbox didn't, did it?
The Xbox did, yes. Because
I spend a lot of time with the original Xbox. But I meant more specifically every Nintendo one, since, like, you know, not a question.
Well, yeah, and, you know, definitely as soon as things went wireless, four controllers has been, you know, the norm. It's actually interesting, because from a strict tech perspective, now that we're wireless, there's no reason to not allow more than four controllers to connect. But for whatever reason, you know, the PlayStation 3 can have more than four controllers connected. But for whatever reason, Nintendo and Microsoft both still get hung up on this four thing.
Well, plus the gamepad.
Yeah, but it's treated from a gameplay perspective as one of four controllers, typically.
Huh.
Although not in, what was that one? Not in Nintendo Land.
Luigi's Ghost Mansion.
Exactly. But, you know, you look at a lot of, like, the Virtual Console actually treats it as the same controller as your first additional controller, which gets really irritating. So, anyway, my point being, 4 controller ports changed the game, changed the expectation, and changed what people could design around. In previous generations, of course, you know, there were games made to use these multi-tap adapters, but they were never the norm. You as a designer, you could never assume your player base is going to have the capacity for 4 players. The Nintendo 64 changed that, and it's something that remains changed today. The expectation now is that if you have a game design that should have 4 players, you're expected to have 4 player support.
Yeah.
And the last one that I think is super notable is the Rumble Pack add-on for the Nintendo 64 controllers. This was the first time that force feedback was open to console gamers. This was another thing I think that people had a really hard time wrapping their head around before it released, with Star Fox 64 actually was the game that had that packed in for Nintendo 64. And before people played it, they did not understand how force feedback was going to work. But now, again, Rumble is like an expected feature. When the six axes didn't Rumble, people were mad.
Yeah.
So, Slaggy, I know there were some add-ons you wanted to talk about, though. So I want to open up the floor to you.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, there wasn't really much for the controller pack. The controller pack was kind of interesting because it could store, like, ghost data, and mostly was for third-party games that, you know, wanted to kind of cut costs for not having game saves on the cartridge proper.
But, because that would require, you know, a battery inside the cartridge that would cost more money.
Yeah, and Quest 64 and Mystical Ninja Starring Goemon both used exclusively save data. Mario Kart 64 used it to store your ghost data, and Animal Forest, which was the Japanese-only, Animal Crossing, used it for traveling to other towns. So that was a really novel idea.
Bomberman 64 used it as well for your single-player progress. But
nice.
I'm sorry, continue.
There was the expansion pack, which is really only notable because it added, you know, more RAM. It added 4 megabytes of RAM, which now we're like, LOL. But that doubled the console RAM from 4 to 8 megabytes.
And that was required for games like Majora's Mask, where...
Donkey Kong 64, and for a lot of games...
I was going to talk about from a design perspective, but alright, go on.
For a lot of games, it allowed the developers to increase the visual details, like Resident Evil 2. It allowed some games to run in a higher resolution or at a higher frame rate.
Looking at you, Perfect Dark.
Yep. So, I mean, just really, it was a real boost. And, you know, all that it replaced was the, what was it called? What was the name of the little thing that it put
Well, they just had a device in there that they just called the Jumper Pack.
The Jumper Pack, right.
And that was just like a little throwaway slot that, you know, is just there until you had the expansion pack.
Pretty much, yeah.
It itself didn't really serve much purpose.
So there was really no reason not to have an expansion pack.
Well, except, you know, they cost money, and not everyone had all the money in the world. I had to buy a copy of Donkey Kong 64 that had it packed in, so that I could play Majora's Mask, because my copy of Majora's Mask did not have one packed in.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's the only reason I own Donkey Kong 64.
DK.
Donkey Kong.
Another one I want to touch on is the transfer pack. We mostly think of this as being, you know, the means as to which we could use our Pokemon in Pokemon Stadium, and you might remember that the original Pokemon Stadium in Japan did not have this feature. It was originally just for North America, I believe, but then they used it for some other games. There was Mario Golf, Mario Tennis both used it in a little bit. A couple of Japanese games did too. But, you know, that was really kind of cool idea at the time to be like, oh, I'm going to, you know, connect my Pokemon data to play it in 3D. You know, I mean, there were similar ideas with the Super Game Boy, but I think it was just really kind of a novel idea. And, you know, now we see, a lot of interplay between portables and console games.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's something that really, to me, was another thing that really changed expectations.
And the VMU kind of did a similar thing, didn't it? Like we talked about last week.
Well, I mean, sort of. I wouldn't overall agree with that because, it didn't let you connect your Game Gear games to your Dreamcast or whatever.
Right, but just in terms of,
again, it's like a sidebar. Like, I don't really think that the transfer pack influenced the VMU. I do think that the transfer pack and philosophy impacted impacted Nintendo in doing later things with, you know, like the GameCube GBA connector.
Right.
And that's the kind of stuff that I think we now are still seeing pop up in, like, games like for PSP and Vita that interact with PS3 and PS4.
Yep.
So, you know, I definitely think that Nintendo's germ of an idea there in the transfer pack sort of evolved over the years to the point where that idea has now been adopted by other developers and platform holders.
Yeah. Now, are we going to talk about the 64 disk drive, or does that deserve its own special flopisode?
So, you know, the thing is, I'd love to do a 64 disk drive episode, but I've never played one.
Yeah.
And I try really hard not to talk too much about stuff here on the show that I have not played. I think it really does a disservice both to our listeners, and it makes us look silly. So,
yeah. You know, we might have to save that for a general episode about hardware flops.
So what I want to say about the 64 disk drive right now is that it was a really great idea. Basically magnetic disk drive for the Nintendo 64, that would really just open up a whole suite of game.
A whole new world.
Customization options and like content creation tools. And, you know, the limited amount of games that did get released for it certainly did have that, as well as games like Doshin the Giant. Those applications are cool. What kills me is, you know, this device came out in Japan, but it did not come out in North America, unfortunately. Even though several North American games still have their quote-unquote programming hooks for these games, such as stuff like F-Zero X is like the go-to example. The F-Zero X DD add-on, like expansion, had a full-fledged track creation tool set that you could create custom tracks for it. Supposedly, these were the same basic tools that Nintendo used for debugging tracks themselves.
Oh, wow.
You know, there's, like, supposed to be a whole suite of, like, art software and, like, sound editing software. So it is just, you know, a lot of the stuff that we see Nintendo doing with, you know, like the DSi and the 3DS using the sound recordings and light video editing and, light image editing, you know.
Yeah.
These things were born sort of from the germ of an idea of the 64 disk drive.
That's just how Nintendo rolls. You talk about the history of the Mii and everything.
Oh, absolutely. The Mii dating back to the Famicom. So we will probably talk about the 64 disk drive again in the future. But again, I just wanted to mention it from legacy terms because we saw a lot of ideas born in this era that Nintendo has still gone back to and tried to make work. And I will bet you swords to plowshares that if we see a new F-Zero game at some point, now that the capacity for it exists, we can just plug in a hard drive into our Wii U. I bet we'll see F-Zero track editor coming up if they do another F-Zero game. So, Slaggy, were there any other tech/legacy issues you wanted to bring up with regard to the 64?
No, just that I think, you know, a lot of people poo-poo the 64 in a lot of ways for being a cartridge-based system. But, you know, you have to really appreciate that some of the cartridges only fit 4 megabytes of data. Some could fit up to 64 megabytes, but I mean, that's still small, like 10% of what could be fit on a CD. And, you know, in a lot of cases, still looking as good or better than things that we saw on the PlayStation.
Well, and that is even crazier when you consider stuff like, you know, what amazing codecs must have come up for the compression of the FMV videos and stuff like the Resident Evil 2 N64 port, which is, by all accounts, and, you know, I have a card of this myself, basically the same game as on the PlayStation 1.
Yeah.
You know, the FMVs are all present. They're certainly super grainy, but they're there, and they run, and you can watch them.
We talked about that with the Pokemon Puzzle League little animation clips.
Yeah. So really, to think that they did that much, like, they squeezed a 2-CD-ROM game down to 64 megs. Like, that's crazy and awesome.
Yeah. I mean, the only other device that I would really add is the microphone, but we kind of talked about that with Pikachu Genki Dichu.
Hey, you Pikachu! And yeah, no, that was a really cool game, but we've talked about it here on the show before.
Yeah,
so.
And I mean, we talked about Seaman last week, so kind of second verse, same as the first.
Indeed.
Less quirky. Except for the part where you have to give the Pikachu away. Goodbye, Pikachu!
How dare you? All right, well, then let's talk about this last talking point, much like we did with the GameCube, much like we did with the Dreamcast last week. I just want to talk very briefly about getting into the Nintendo 64 scene now. You know, unlike the Dreamcast, Sega is dead, as, like, having their own platform and everything. We sometimes see Dreamcast games get ported to Steam or Xbox Live Marketplace, but they're not a platform holder like Nintendo is. The cool thing about Nintendo being a platform holder, even still, is that a lot of these first-party games we've talked about here are still easily purchasable on the Wii Shop.
Or you can get them on Virtual Console. Or DS remakes.
Or get, you know, remakes for them very easily. Still in production, a lot of these games are. So if you're interested in the games that we talked about, you can still get them super easily. On the off chance you're looking for something like Quest 64, you're looking for Bomberman 64, you know, Goemon 64, pretty much your only option if you want to get into these games is either to illicitly emulate, which, you know, I'm certainly not going to judge you for. Nobody's making money off that handful of games. But, really, if you prefer to get a cart, and I personally do prefer to get carts in game, in situations like this, you can find Nintendo 64s online for typically $30 to $50.
Not bad.
And a lot of these games, even the rarer ones, can be had for, you know, $5 to $20. You do occasionally see outliers where they're, you know, $60 to $80, but those are more outliers. I'm looking at an eBay auction right now, for example, that is a lot of GoldenEye and Quest 64 for $9.99.
That's not bad.
So, you know, definitely do your research, do some shopping.
Pay three times that to get a Square Enix game on a smartphone.
But that's a lot of money.
But, you know, it's definitely, I think it's worthwhile because a lot of these games are unlikely to ever get Virtual Console re-releases or whatever. And they're absolutely games that are worth playing. We wouldn't have talked about them on this episode if we didn't believe that. So, I think it's worthwhile. I think that there's a lot of great games on this platform. And Slaggy, unless you have anything else to say, I think it's time to move on.
Gotta go on, gotta go on.
Wrong song.
Yeah, wrong song. And wrong platform too.
I said, hey, what's going on?
So, I have mostly been playing this little game. You might not have ever heard of it. It's called Super Smash Bros. For 3DS.
How's that possible, Capbike? That's not out yet.
Oh, you silly Willy.
Are you one of those internet pirates?
Well, I mean, yes, but also no. you know, I certainly bought the game for my import 3DS.
Yes.
I just crossed, like, the 40-hour line.
Wow.
Yeah, right? This game's been out for, like, a week and a half. But anyway, it's incredible. It is amazing. It is everything we have known it would be for the last several years. Luckily, from a technical perspective now, there is a demo available in North America,
yep.
So you can play it, you can see it really does run at 60 frames a second, gameplay stuff you love is really there, and I'll be honest, I feel about Smash Bros. 4 3DS the same way that I felt about Mario Kart 8, like I feel like this is a culmination of everything that has come from this series so far, all pulled together in the best package that the series has ever seen.
And man, just what it means for Smash Brothers for Wii U.
Yeah, oh man, I cannot wait.
Yeah, I was able to play a little bit with you on the demo, which, you know, limits your amount of characters you can choose from. But I got to try out Mega Man. Mega Man seems like a lot of fun. I just need to kind of learn him better. But I mostly relied on my old standby Pikachu. And, you know, controls really well. I mean, not floaty like Brawl. Really plays a lot more like Melee does. And I mean, you know, just really seamless transition to 3DS.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I would say compared to scenes like Street Fighter 4 on the 3DS, it feels a lot more natural.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that statement. The other game I've been playing a lot of recently is Destiny. You know, Destiny, it really taught me something about myself. You know, between this and Titanfall, I've come to realize
Have you become Legend?
I have become Legend, because I have one piece of Legendary gear.
Ah.
But, you know, so between Destiny and Titanfall, I've come to realize I don't dislike first-person shooters for being first-person shooters. I dislike them because I find most of them terribly boring. Destiny is not boring. I love the ability progression in the game. I love the way that it's balanced. I love gear. I love that unlike something like Borderlands, where you're getting a new weapon every 3 minutes and your weapons never make any difference, in Destiny, when you get a new weapon, you're actually going to keep it for a little while more often than not.
Yeah.
And so you actually really do sort of like, oh man, I really dig this weapon. I really like this weapon. I don't want to throw it away. I'm having a really interesting time with Destiny. I reached the level cap very quickly because I'm really enjoying doing the PvP bounties and stuff, so I'm getting tons of XP. So I'm only like halfway through the game's story mode, but I actually really like the story so far, even though the way it's told is a little bit jank. Like, it is by far, like, I'm seeing a lot of people like, oh, that's the most boring story I've ever seen in a game. Oh, the way the narration is delivered is so bad. And I'm just like, dude, do you really play a lot of bad games? Because it doesn't sound like it. Like, this game is not bad at all. I've heard people call it mediocre, but, like, the game controls are so tight, and shooting all of the various guns and special ability grenades, and even the way that, like, melee combat works, I just feel like everything feels super tight and good. Like, I would describe everything as, like, oh, that's the real sweet spot for that kind of attack. So I guess I feel like, you know, a game with a 10-hour story that controls perfectly is better than a 20-hour game that controls like shit.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking at you, Borderlands.
Borderlands 2.
I'll be honest.
Boringlands,
that's a good way to put it. Like, I just feel like every enemy in Borderlands is just a bullet sponge. Everything drops weapons all the time, so you're constantly going through, like, a loot roulette. It's just not my thing. Destiny is my thing. Slaggy, how about you? What have you been playing?
I briefly mentioned the Smash Brothers 3DS demo, but I've mostly been putting more time into World of Warcraft. I don't really need to elaborate on that, so...
You're playing Destiny and you want to play with me, I'm on PS4. You can friend request me on PSN. I'm Origami Pirate.
Wonderful.
One word.
Origami Pirate.
So, all right. Well, if you don't have any other games to talk about, Slaggy, then maybe you should get our social links up.
Sure. I'd like to start out with some twiddly tweets. Twiddly tweets! Exactly. We got a few Twitter follow-ups from our last episode. The first one comes from Cheeto16, saying, I'm going to have to write an email to share my feels on the DC. Also, did you catch the Ultra 64 mention in the Blood ad? It totally made me giggle. Right, and how appropriate timing for Ultra 64. We did get your email, Cheeto, and so we will be sharing that at the end of our social links. It was a very heartfelt feels for the Dreamcast. The Book Pirate points out, I need to correct you, Space Channel 5 Part 1 and 2 were released on PS2 in the US as a bundle. Space Channel 5 Part 2 came out on 360 Steam PS3. And you are totally right. Thank you for the correction.
Yep.
Fix Your Face, also known as Jeremy Johnson from the award-winning Koopa Club podcast, says, more big ups to Spike Point and Slagkick on their Dreamcast retrospective on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
VG Realness, Video Game Realness, says, Koopa Club, GameBuoy.org, Game Bar, Horde House, OLR, hashtag the Hunty Bunch, hashtag love. Aww.
We heart you.
Now, I want to get on to our social links question of the week. This week we're discussing the Nintendo 64 on episode 64 of Game Buoy. What was your experience with the N64? Did you get one at launch? What are your favorite N64 games? Over on Twitter, we got Strawberry Wish sent us a tweet. Said, first system I ever played on when I was in college, when it was 10 years old. Well, better late than never is my attitude. Such a gem of a console, and, you know, like we said, still a lot of value and worth in playing it today.
Absolutely.
Such gem, such an important part of gaming history. Over on the Book of Faces, that sounds like a Silent Hill Book of Faces.
Silent Hill Book of Faces.
Daniel T says, I got one for Christmas after launch, and I spent a lot of time playing Super Mario 64, of course, Wave Race 64, beautiful through my nostalgia glasses, plus dolphin riding, and Pilot Wing 64. Woohoo! With my father, a retired Army helicopter pilot. Looking back, I really only had a few games, but I always had fun renting random games from Turok, Clay Fighters. Oh yeah, Turok. Finally, the N64 had the only two first-person shooters I'm good at, GoldenEye and Pokemon Snap. Aw, Snap? We didn't talk about Snap. We did talk about it in our Pokemon episode, though. But
no, incredible game. I love it.
Really,
it's silly to me we don't have a new
shooter.
One.
It's a rail shooter, kind of, huh? Yeah.
Great game, yeah.
Except I'm only really good at GoldenEye when I hide at the end of the corridor, laced with hundreds of proximity mines. Ah, memories.
That is an absolutely valid strategy. I'm sorry. It was a great idea.
Renee A. from the Killer Queens from Outer Space podcast said, I didn't get one at launch, but my friend in college did, with MK Trilogy, and we played that game nonstop until, of course, Mario Kart 64 was released. Then Friday nights were spent drinking and playing Mario Kart 64, both Grand Prix and Time Trial modes. To beat my friend's time on Banshee Boardwalk, Chaco Mountain, to Mario Stadium by a tenth of a second was the best thing ever. Man, that just makes me realize how young I was compared to a lot of people I know. I was like, I was in middle school. I don't know if you were drinking when you were playing Mario Kart, but that's our experience now.
Yeah, right.
Playing Mario Kart, but man, that must have been so fun. Only thing a little bit more fun is drinking and playing SNES, which you can do now. All right, but anyway,
keep on going.
Jeremy Johnson from the Koopa Club podcast said, I got my N64 maybe a year after it launched. I was in 7th grade, IDK, but the only reason I got it was because my mom struck a deal with me, fixed my awful grades to B's and A's, and she'd buy me a Nintendo 64. I've never been particularly motivated to do well in school, mostly because I'm just not good at learning things in general, but you better believe I changed my grades to get that 64. Of course, afterwards, they went right back to the death because I was too busy exploring Peach's Castle. My favorite game is obviously Mario 64, but I'd also like to highlight Castlevania 64 as a game that is far better than most people give it credit for, has great atmosphere, and it was actually quite engaging. And yeah, you were just saying that just a few minutes ago in regard to the Castlevania score game.
Yeah.
You know, we'd also talked about that on our
Castlevania episode, as I noted.
Episode, yes. And over on the Google Plus, we got a comment from Colin, a.k.a. the Book Pirate, saying, my experience was the typical GoldenEye, Zelda, Ocarina of Time, Banjo-Kazooie experience that most other N64 gamers had. But I also remember some underappreciated games such as Hybrid Heaven, Shadowgate 64, and Space Station Silicon Valley, all of which will never probably see re-releases. All right, and with that, we go over to the Mailbuoy Mailbag.
Mailbuoy Mailbag!
So as we mentioned, Cheeto, a.k.a. Francisco Yu, sent us a lovely two-part All the Dreamcast Feels email. All the Dreamcast Feels! All the Dreamcast Feels! Uh-oh. That was us, not him. My dearest Captain Spike and Slagkick, it hath been far too long since I last wrote an email to thee. Fear not, for your voices have been carried across the sea of the interwebs. Alas, the time hath cometh for me to writeth and emaileth, even knoweth I'm lateth for the Dreamcast episode. Okay, that last sentence was ridiculous. Back to normal. So, yeah, the Dreamcast social question of the week totally flew past me, and I didn't get to tweet or respond on LeFaceSpace. After hearing a ton of responses, not just on Gamebuoy, but other podcasts as well, I'm glad to know the Dreamcast certainly has a special place in many of people's hearts. I honestly felt like I was one of few who looked back fondly on the years I had spent with the Dreamcast, but not so much anymore. Back in the day, I only knew my brother and I to be the only kids around my neighborhood with a Dreamcast. In fact, we only knew one other kid to have a Dreamcast in our entire school. I have four things that I automatically think about when the Dreamcast is brought up. Christmas, Chaptic, Chow Raising, and Jet Set Radio.
Oh, I hope that you're going to go into all of this.
In the beginning, I wasn't interested in the Dreamcast, but my brother really wanted it, and he got it for his birthday in the middle of 2000. He was so into it that he subscribed to the Dreamcast magazine, and once I was hooked on the Dreamcast, we spent so much time playing it, like a lot of time. Two of my associations I mentioned above come from one of the Dreamcast magazine's demos discs that came with a special Christmas-themed Toy Commando demo. I fucking played the shit out of that demo, and I honestly don't remember why. I just remember being able to switch between a tank that climbed up walls, an airplane, and a Jeep. You were given a mission to round up presents before midnight, and other toys tried to stop you. Again, IDKY, but I love the background music, and even sometimes hum the tune out of the blue, especially around Christmas. Also Chapstick. Why Chapstick, you ask? It was during the demo I tried the Chapstick that forever changed my lips. Ooh, hey! That got that lip smacker's realness, girl. I still use the same kind to this day, and the smell taste of it totally takes me back to the Dreamcast days. Aww, like memory association. With Sonic Adventure and Sonic Adventure 2, I spent way too much time with the virtual pets in the game. I had a Knight's Chow in the first Sonic Adventure. Now, in Sonic Adventure 2, I believe there were three Chow that I took care of. The first was a Shadow Chow that had green stripes instead of red ones. This Chow remains in my VMU because you could transfer it to the device, interact with it, and boost stats. More on why it's still in the VMU later. Anyway, this obsession got carried over into the GameCube port of Sonic Adventure 2, in which I raised another Shadow Chow, but this one was an all-lime green color. The third and last Chow was one I bred to get perfect stats, so that I could get the ultimate evil Chow. I got so burnt out that I never obtained it. Kinda like me with Chocobo breeding.
Yeah, no, I loved the Chows. I loved having them on my VMU. I would take them to class with me my senior year of high school.
They're like, are you playing a Tamagotchi? And you're like, no.
Yeah, most of my friends were sophisticated enough that they knew what
no,
it was.
No, I mean like some rando girl next to you like, is that a Tamagotchi? Oh my god. Anyway, back to Cheeto's email. Jet Set Radio. Words cannot get close to describing the love and emotion I get from this game. Everyone has a game that forever changes their view on video games. Not only did Jet Set Radio do that, it completely changed the way I felt about music. It is the reason why I am into electronic music to this day. JSR was so different in many ways from typical video games, and it blew me away. Not just graphically, but in the gameplay and objectives. The music blended so well with the vibe of the game, and exposed me to Guitar Vader, who are no longer together, but I have a few albums of theirs. I love the music so much that Super Brothers, Magical Girl, and Bat the Town were some of my first pirated songs back when Audio Galaxy was a thing. Those songs are on my first mix CD, and now that I think about it, Jet Set Radio was around the time I got my first computer and began really getting into technology. Wow, that's kind of a huge turning point in my life. Anyway, I latch onto the music, and the art direction was super memorable. JSR was graphic and in your face, and loud and colorful. Honestly, I still dream that when I go to Japan, it will be like I stepped into Jet Set Radio, because I want to live in a neon, colorful, graphically wonderful, futuristic world, damn it.
Aww. Spoiler alert, when you go to Japan, it will be like that.
Like, JSR was so influential to me that I found big, round, yellow lens glasses that looked like Beats, and I wore them around not giving a fuck what people thought. This was pre-digital cameras day, so unfortunately I don't have a picture on hand. And because we're sticking with the Dreamcast, I won't go too much into Jet Set Radio Future. All I would say is that I love Jet Set Radio Future more so than Jet Set Radio, and I want a remake.
Yep.
And the soundtrack to both games have gone from my mini disc player to my iPod and every iPhone I've owned. There's also the whack-ass commercial that I love as well.
And that commercial is amazing. Like, bad, but amazing. Like, you were saying earlier about the promo videos for Nintendo.
Yeah. Anyway, there are tons of other games I could talk about forever. Crazy Taxi, Power Stone 1 and 2, Skies of Arcadia, Marvel vs. Capcom 2, Oh My Glob, and the Spider-Man video game too, and Tony Hawk 1 and 2. Okay, I'm going to stop before it's too late. Needless to say, I have much love for the Dreamcast, and I'm sad the life of the system was cut short. Holy crap, that was a long email. Sorry for the novel. Heart you guys, Francisco, aka Cheetah 2. And
then there's a part 2.
There's a little addendum. All the Dreamcast feels part 2. It says, I forgot one part about my Dreamcast story. The end was bitter not because of the short lifespan, but because my uncle stole our game, my brother and I's entire Dreamcast collection, so that he could pawn them for drug money. This is why my Shadow Chow remains in my VMU. The data has probably been wiped because I haven't replaced the battery in forever, but I'd like to believe the ghost of my Chow still haunts the VMU, maybe. Okay, for realsies, that's it. Still heart you guys, Francisco, aka Cheetah 16.
I choose to believe that your Shadow Chow will remain forever.
Man, that was almost like an NPR, like, personal essay about Dreamcast. That was amazing.
I loved it. That was amazing.
That was amazing.
Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For your letter.
And with that, we love your feedback. We like your iTunes subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. We like your Facebook likes. We fucking love Twitter.
We effing love Twitter, for seriousness.
We like it when you tumble with us on Tumblr and plus one us on Google. One. What are you doing? Are you being Banshee Boardwalk?
I don't know what that is. Keep going.
Boo, Boardwalk, whatever. And, of course, you can always access all of our social links along with our entire episode archive on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
And if you want to mail us, like Cheeto did, you can mail us at MailBuoy@GameBuoy.org.
MailBuoy@GameBuoy.org. Also, you need to make sure that we have a more direct email link to MailBuoy on our website. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, I'll do that. With that, would you like to shout out some shout-outs?
As ever and always, I'd like to shout out to Koopa Club. That's Koopa with a Q and Club with a K. Koopa Club is an award-winning podcast about Nintendo and gaming with an LGBT twist. I also want to mention VG Realness, serving up a weekly dose of gaming chit-chat among friends, plus the Game Over Takeover, your one-stop shop to go to for geekery galore. I'd be remiss not to mention Orange Lounge Radio, where every gamer has a voice and from whom I steal ever so many of my cues. In non-gaming podcasts, I have to mention Slagkick's show, Reading is Fundamental, on which himself, myself, Rob Roberts from Orange Lounge Radio,
himself,
Delvin from VG Realness, all dish about the current episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. Accordingly, that show is presently off-season, but as soon as the next season starts, expect to see more of us. I also must mention the Starboard Power Coupling Podcast, a Star Trek podcast you hope doesn't fail.
Starboard.
Last, but certainly not least, I need to mention X Nation over at culturalwormhole.blogspot.com, an awesome podcast focusing on Marvel's Mighty Mutants. And now, I believe Slackkick wants to take you to a game bar.
Yes, Game Bar is the podcast that fills your brain space with hours of gay video game commentary. They're part of the Hunt Bunch, and basically the gay video game prairie home companion starring Lindsay Lohan. Yes, God, Mama. I'd also like to shout out to the Nerdgasm Network, the wildest shock jock video game radio show that you will ever come across. It's a bag of hot dicks. Over on the Voice of Geeks Network, that's vognetwork.com, you can find two fantastic shows about online gaming. One is Horde House, the show about all things online gaming but never too seriously. And Girls Gone WoW, where you can get a female's perspective on the world's most popular MMO. And last but certainly not least, I'd like to shout out to La Palanca Podcast, podcast por y para gay gamers latinoamericanos en español. As ever and always, I'd like to pour out a 40 for our late great Zelda Reorchestrated, the project that aimed to recreate Zelda music in beautiful symphonic sound, and whose beautiful tunes you still enjoy today as the opening and closing music of this podcast.
Well, with all that having been said, thank you kindly, our dear, lovely, beautiful listeners, for spending this lovely Sunday afternoon with us. We really appreciate it. I hope you've had as much fun listening as we've had talking. We have some exciting stuff coming up for you next month. It is, after all, the month of spoopiness. So please look forward to that. In the meantime, though, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
And I did not prepare a statement for the end of this episode.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Mics are hot.
Hot mics, hot mics. Get your hot mics here.
All right, our levels look good. I hit mic check to came in.
I like to check out Magic Mike.
Hey. You ready?
Y'all ready for this?
Okay, but that's not an answer.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Sure. Shining Gang.
No, over me. Batman Arkham Knight launches June 2nd, 2015. We also have...
Speaking of summer 2015, Bandai Namco has told us that, well, not us, they told IGN, actually, and then... Oh my god, news!
First up here, we have confirmation last week, blah, 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 blah. And I just forgot the name of Homeboy. Ah.
Now, no cutting corners, Captain Spike, what you been playing? Daniel T. says, I got one for the Christmas...
I got one for the Christmas.
I'm gonna start over. Twiddly tweets!
End cut.